This is Indie Book Publishing. Indie Book Publishing is a show about new books and the authors who wrote them. It's an opportunity for prospective readers to hear directly from the writers, to hear what inspired them to write and publish, and to hear all the inside details about their books. And now, Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen.
The title of the book, Expressions of an Inward Path, Insights of a Pathless Journey. And the author and poet is Gigi. And Gigi joins us now on Indie Book Publishing, this interview brought to you by Balboa Press. Hello, Gigi.
Hello, Steve.
Great to have you with us all the way from Malaysia. It's going to be an interesting discussion because your book is filled with poems, but at the same time, you say you're not a poet. So we'll talk more about that. But you also say this. The poems composed and compiled here are from inspirations in different states of mind. The mind which was inquiring, the mind which was left alone, the mind which realized, the mind which was interpreting experiences of its doubts and awakening. You also say this, that your book is unique and unlike others, with a similar kind of theme, because it's written uniquely by a different person based on a person's conditionings and moments of expression that itself differs one from another. How would you describe your poems? I mean, you were feeling them at a certain moment in time because of experiences you were having.
Well, basically when I began to become authentic in feeling my feelings, and basically, I wouldn't say speaking to them, but merely like really being inquisitive about them. These were the words that came as if they were just expressing themselves.
And so these expressions of, you say expressions come because the answers lie within?
Yeah, I mean, starting from the journey, I mean, as you said earlier, the whole book is about a journey that I once took. It was part of my life. And I think if anyone has read my book, the first poem itself, like the symbol, it was really about recognizing something that was symbolizing, something that was a symbol in the mind, but projected outwards. And then through the inquiry and through that inquisitiveness, so that sincerity in really wanting to know the truth, and the others revealed.
Well, you say, I'm just an ordinary person like anyone walking on the face of the earth, and you have things to do and chores and duties, and you're enjoying the mundane and yet the spontaneous activities, but you're also feeling things that are, you're kind of inviting the world to look and reflect inwards along with you.
Yep, I am.
Well, let's go ahead.
Well, basically, we have this impression, or at least I do, and when I speak to a lot of people, they think that basically these things, reflecting inwards, are things that for people who are really depressed or people who are like wanting to be monks or live in some cave to attain enlightenment, or I don't know, to be a real wise person. But in my own experience of living an ordinary life, I didn't do anything that was extraordinary. In fact, I think I only attended one retreat, and that was because I was invited, and I didn't really participate in the retreat as well. A lot of people have ideas that when they need to attend something or do something different from what they're already doing in order to attain a certain kind of wisdom or enlightenment, which in my experience was not necessary, because the only thing that really needed our attention was our sincerity to reflect inward each time when something arises within us.
You talk about the spiritual journey is indeed a lonely one. Now, just talk about that, this lonely experience, this lonely journey. What do you mean by that?
Well, basically, we are experiencing everything alone. Say if my cat died, I would feel sad. And if I told someone about it, they will probably imagine how sad I am, but they won't be able to experience how sad I am. But I would think that, oh, they're being sad for me and they're being sad with me, which is totally an illusion. So as you realize that, as I realize that, everything that came up in me, whether I'm angry or I am sad or I'm happy, I just realize that I'm all alone. Even if I'm sharing my joys or my sorrows with someone else, I can never know if that person is feeling exactly the way I'm feeling. I am just sharing a story and they're interpreting it by the way they would perceive it anyway, and they'll be experiencing whatever they're experiencing, and which can be totally different from mine. But say, for example, in a funeral, everyone's crying. Well, they feel sadness, but it's in different intensities for different reasons, and we don't really know, but we're assuming that everyone is crying for the same reason just because I'm doing that.
So this is the voice of the heart.
Well, it's a realization.
Okay, and you also talk about this, it takes brutal honesty and the willingness to take responsibility to be authentic with oneself.
Yes.
Well, let's hear a few of your poems. Why don't we start are you going to start with this one called The Symbol?
Yeah, sure. That's the one that got me writing.
Okay. Why don't we do that?
Okay. The Symbol, written on September 11th, 2009. I'm thinking of you. Thoughts of you swim in my mind. I don't know why. Perhaps I do know. The answer is there, but I'm unwilling to look. Because once I look, and then I know, I might lose this feeling when I think of you. I'm full of gratitude. I don't know if it comes from guilt. So do I want to know? In some ways I do, but in some other ways I don't. I might lose this feeling, you see, when I think of you. My heart is bursting with expressions, and these feelings are all associated with you. I think I love you. I know I love you. But these are only meanings in the mind, all conditioned and concluded. Is there a you? I do not know. For if I did, you'd disappear. I want to let you go. But yet if I do, I'm afraid I'd lose this feeling, along with you. Along with you with it. What if I never find it again? What if it is emptiness that fills the void? I know who the culprit is, the idea of lack. And yet, I'm afraid to look. Because if I do, I know that it is not you that I'm missing. And it is not you that I'm thinking about. You're just a symbol. You're just a cast. You're just my scapegoat, albeit in a good way. For whatever that I feel, or I think I feel, and yes, I do know how very unreal they are, yet, why do I not see? Because I don't want to see. Because if I'd seen, then I know that I'm alone, that there has never been another. I would have to take responsibility for this emptiness inside, this loneliness inside, and it is scary, frightening, to even think of that space I belong to. I know you love me too, and I know these feelings might have been overwhelming, but you are wise, because you already know. I am but only a symbol for you to source what you thought you had lacked. Do I practice what you practice? And when you transcend me as a symbol, my sufferings remain, for I might think you have left me all alone again. Nowhere else to hide, nowhere else to go. You decline the role of my scapegoat. So I will take the courageous step now, so that you will always remain with me, because you as a symbol has never left me, because you as a symbol had always been within. First, it would take that willingness, and then that gradually, and then I come into this space to reclaim and break the symbol you represent, to be responsible, accountable, to find out that there's never been emptiness, not even loneliness. There's always been love, and there hasn't even been a me.
That certainly sounded like the voice of the heart.
Thank you.
So, is that, now that relationship obviously had a profound impact on you, and you were kind of searching your innermost feelings of really trying to of not only identify with what was going on, but to understand why?
Well, yeah, because it's not possible that when you like someone and then, or when you love someone, that when that someone goes away, you kind of feel empty when it's not really leaving you. It's like we all have this perception that when we meet someone or when we love someone, we need that person to be around. And that's not really true. Because if we really love that someone, we would actually bless that person to do whatever that they wanted, even if it means leaving your sight, leaving you in that context. Yeah. We don't harbor hatred or anger or disappointments towards that person. If that does arise, it is mainly because they're actually our symbol of something in the mind, and it's projected out onto them, and therefore we are not really in love with them, but really in love, what we're really looking at then is actually a symbol.
Well, why don't you share another one with us? What would you like to share with us?
You mean a poem?
Yes.
Another poem? Oh. Well, probably I'll go with Love Awaits.
Okay.
Yeah, this was something that I realized after I've transcended the symbol, almost, or part of it. It was a time when I realized that when I didn't meet this person, because there was always this thing that if I didn't meet this person, then I probably didn't love this person. That's why it was like so fate that I was going to lose this feeling. And then I realized that it wasn't going to happen because love remains. And here goes. Love Awaits, written on May 14, 2010. I do think of you, I cannot deny that, and I know you think of me too. Only I don't know how much less. And you tell me that you love me, and I love you too. But are we eyeing the symbols we are to each other, or are we seeing the bodies that are separate? When I begin to miss you, I know that I'm separated from you. But as soon as I'm whole, even when you are far, I feel as if we are one. So have we ever been separated? Except in this delusional illusion, or have we always been one, only we have not remembered? And there you are with your pain, and here I am with mine. When we start to work within, we come back together as one. It's as if the separation never existed. It's as if the pain was never there. What remains is unspoken love, you say, when bodies are put aside. And the mornings, the afternoons, the evenings go by. Nothing divides the dancing of minds. When the yin and the yang meet, the balance restored, it remains only essence, only love awaits.
The themes of your book, you cite relationships, love, conceptual truths in a society as a whole. Who am I and what am I? The mind. Do you have one short one that you could share? We've got enough time for another short one.
Get to know me.
Okay. All right.
This one is written on February 2011. I'm not here to scare you, nor am I here to rule you. I'm here merely to please you, but you don't know what I am. You have been asleep. I have no choice but to regulate. Not that I could not provide better, but these are set in the system. The system is not placed by me. Still, I have to run it. This is the best I know to bring to you what you intend. But because you are not alert, your intent not made known to you, you go on blaming the outer, insensible to what you have reached. Many has told you of me, you actually secretly remember me, yet you shunt me away as if I can be concealed. Why are you running away? Why are you not seeing right? The more you shunt me away, the closer I am to you. Until you get to know me, until you learn of my existence, until you see what you've done to me, then you'd see how you've become. I'm not your enemy, neither am I your lover. I'm merely a servant when you're ready to be master. But until you understand me, I still run the show. When you're ready to take over, pass the test you must. I can be very tricky, this you have to know. And it is not that I choose to be, but it's how you make me so. At each trine you reign, know it is your greatness. Stop at nothing though, for I'm trained to come back. Not because I hate you or mean to bring you down, but I have to be sure that you are now the master.
The title of the book, Expressions of an Inward Path, Insights of a Pathist Journey. And the author and poet is Gigi. Gigi, tell us how to get your book.
Well, I believe through Bowboy and some Bowboy Press, and it's available in a soft copy and also in soft cover, and also ebooks. I think it's sold in Amazon and all the connected network of Bowboy Press.
Well, thank you, Gigi, for being with us on Indie Book Publishing. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
And this interview is brought to everyone by Balboa Press.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages. Get ready to live La Bella Vita with Dawn Catherine on Toginet.com. Live La Bella Vita. If you're wanting to know all the beauty tricks of the trade and the latest fashion trends before everyone else, this is your show. If you admire celebrities' beauty and their fashion sense, this is your show. Do you love wine and want to know more about the process it takes to make wine from the vine to the bottle? This is your show. Live La Bella Vita. For more on the show and your host, check out our website, labellavitacosmetico.com. This is the kind of show you can sink your teeth into. If you enjoy traveling and food and family, all with an Italian flair, then you can live La Bella Vita with your host, Dawn Catherine. Wednesday nights at midnight, 11 p.m. Central on Toginet.com. Mark Lipinski is coming to Toginet. It's Creative Mojo with Mark Lipinski, a live two-hour show Wednesday afternoon starting at 3, 2 Central on Toginet.com. Creative Mojo. It's fun, entertaining, informative, inspirational, and illuminating. Lipinski has worked on such shows as Oprah, The View, The Joan Rivers Show, and Ricky Lake. He's busy, but he's got the drive to share with Creative Mojo, dedicated to the modern crafter and crafting lifestyle. Dive into the info and enjoy everything from celebs to entertainment news to recipes, quilting and needlework, knitting, painting, woodworking, Christmas crafts, and so much more. This show boldly encourages you to discover and harness your own creative spirit by living creatively every day. For more on Mark and the show, check out marklipinski.com. Don't miss the fun. It's Creative Mojo with Mark Lipinski, Wednesday afternoon starting at 3, 2 Central on toginet.com. Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
The title of the book, A Change of Habit, A Spiritual Journey from Sister Mary Kateri to Sister Mary Vodka, Seven Secrets to Guilt-Free Living. And the author is Patty Kogatek, and Patty joins us now on Indie Book Publishing, this interview brought to you by Balboa Press. Hello, Patty.
Hello, Steve.
Well, great to have you with us. This is going to be quite a change of habit experience for all of us, because you're going to take us into the convent and out of the convent as a nun, as well as experiences getting married and going through some of the challenges there to your happiness now. So let me just read in general this short statement. You say, find out the seven secrets to guilt-free living. In this memoir, a young girl struggled to find happiness with God in the convent and chronicles her battles to overcome the habit of guilt after she leaves. Take us back, Patty. How old were you when you had this real strong feeling that you needed to become a nun?
I was 17 years old at a Catholic girls' school in Omaha, Nebraska, and a retreat priest, he gave some guidelines for women and young girls who were thinking about being a nun, and he said there would probably be five characteristics that they would have. And being the kind of the guilt sponge that I was, listening to others and trying to please Heavenly Father and Earthly Father, I had four of those characteristics, and I didn't have the fifth one, which was a nun or a priest hadn't encouraged me to enter the convent. So I kind of thought I was off the hook for going into the convent. And then about 3 months later, our parish priest came over for dinner, and of course he asked what I was going to do the next year after I graduated. And I told him that I was probably going to the University of Nebraska. I wasn't quite sure. And then he dropped the bomb, and he said, well, you know, I think you would be a wonderful nun. You have the personality, and the church would need you. Well, that's all I needed. And so the guilt sponge that I am kind of put that in the back of my mind and think, I have all five characteristics. God really wants me in that convent. That's how I got there.
From that spiritual experience, I guess that's what you were feeling, weren't you?
Yes, I felt like God was calling me, and working through the parish priest and the nuns and my family, and that was certainly in our Catholic faith and in our families at that time, it was, you know, people didn't look at it as they do today. It wasn't as rare. It was a gift from God, a vocation, that your child would be called to serve the church.
But it wasn't easy for you.
Oh, no, no. It was difficult. I mean, especially now as you look back on what we did back then, you know, 40 years ago, seems kind of severe and archaic by today's standards. And it was back then, too. The thinking back then was you had to leave your family and your friends behind so you could follow the church and you could concentrate on the spiritual world and your relationship with God and leave the materialistic world behind. So that those first 2 years were cloister years where mail was censored, there were no phone calls, there were no newspapers, we were told whom to talk to, what to talk about, and it was like being in a boot camp.
You stayed in the convent for 7 years. Do most former nuns talk about it like you are? Why are you doing this?
I don't think most nuns do. I think there are a couple other books out there, a few other books, some over in England. Like I said at the beginning, it was difficult to write, and you don't know how it's going to be, you know, received. And you just want to, like when I left the convent, all I wanted to do is blend in. I didn't want people to know that I had been in the convent. And you want to blend in. You want to make your own friends and make your own life, and that's kind of a past life. So I read it. I wrote the book because I really think that God wanted me to write the book. Now's the time to do it. There's a lot of people out there searching for God or spirit, creator. They don't know if it's an organized religion or where it is. I mean, organized religion sometimes gets in the way, and that's secret number one. You know, don't let religion get in the way of your relationship with God. And I think that religion has gotten in the way, and then religion has let some people down in how they've, you know, worked with the faithful.
And you found, as people who met you for the first time and started getting to know your background, that they were really fascinated and wanted to know about your life as a nun.
Right. They wanted to know. They were not only curious, but they wanted to know how I made the jump from being so submissive and obedient and humble to a strong, vibrant person that I am today. And it was the process of working through the guilt of becoming my own person, living my life for myself without feeling selfish, without thinking of others first, like we were brought up to think of others first. And I still think of others first, because I think it's the thing to do, but now I watch out for my own happiness. And that's kind of the reason I wrote the book, so people would reflect on their own lives and see what is, you know, what's making them happy and what's not, what's working for you, and then to promote and protect your own happiness, because choices we make every day get us into situations that we, so how do we get out of this? How did I get into this? What's the right thing to do? So a lot of this, these seven secrets that I write about are just, they're not original. I've picked them up from along the way, things that helped me. And in the book, after each few chapters, I give a secret and then I write a reflection, like what I did in my life that, you know, worked and what didn't work. And then there's a kind of a moral or something that we can all take away from this. So you actually have a little self-help by learning from my missteps.
Was there some event or something that you experienced that led you to leave? What was the cause of that?
When I was, the first year I was in the convent, that very strict novitiate year, I entered in September, and my parents moved from Omaha out to San Diego area in November. So I could not see them for a whole year. And phone conversations that I had at Christmas time, or, you know, the novice mistress was listening to it, letters, I say, were censored. And so I was so excited to get home to California for my visit. It was a week in during the summer. So I flew from Omaha to San Diego, and my parents met me, and we went to their home. Now, it wasn't the home that I left. It was totally different. There weren't the elm trees. There were palm trees. There were, you know, we didn't eat roast beef. We ate tacos. I didn't have a room there. They showed me around the house, and my things were, you know, my mother didn't bring all my clothes and all my stuff. So I kind of felt like an outsider there. So when I went back, I just stayed in the convent because I was more secure there than I was out in California. So it kind of went on until I was very, very lonely, and the things in the church were bothering me, the position on birth control, just a whole lot of things. And so before final vows, I finally told Mother Superior that I had to leave. And so, and then I did leave right before final vows.
So you get out of the convent and you want to become normal, say, so
right,
to speak. I mean, this,
right,
you want to be like everyone else.
Right.
So did that rush to be normal, was that part of your decision to marry?
Yes. I have two younger sisters who were married and were having children. And at that time, the thinking was if you wanted to be married, you had to have the children. And by the time you're 30, your biological clock is ticking away. And I felt behind. I didn't have a family. I didn't have a job. So I just tried to get back into society as quickly as possible. So I met a very nice man. He was Catholic. He had never been married before. He, of course, didn't have any children. And he was a good catch at the time. And so I thought, oh, this is what I need. And so I jumped in before I was ready. It had nothing to do with him. It had everything to do with me.
How long did the marriage last?
The marriage lasted 12 years.
12 years, was it something that you knew that you were going to leave well before that, but you just hung in there?
What happened after, it was a vacation that my husband and I took, and we came back, and I was showing everybody the pictures. And the one lady said, now, did your husband go? And I said, yes, and she said, he's not in any of these pictures. And I said, well, he stayed in the room and watched TV and relaxed, and I was out around the pool meeting everybody, talking, and having a good time. And so then the lady said, well, did you have a good time? And I said, yes. And she said, well, then did you have a good time with your husband? And I could not answer that. I said, ooh, I don't know. So I stopped to think about it. And I had a good time in spite of him, not because of him. And so I looked again at the marriage and how I had just kind of blended right into his life, like I blended into the convent, and really did some examination for about 2 years. I had to think what made me happy, what situations I liked, what really was my happiness. And then I knew I had to move on. I knew that it was me. And so I had to deal with the idea of getting a divorce in the Catholic Church.
Well, in the last chapter, you talk about marrying for the third time, but this time with full maturity, knowledge, and freedom. And you were open, I guess. You were determined to also be happy.
Yes. I mean, I knew something was kind of wrong with me. I mean, you can't be married to God and another wonderful man and still not be happy. Something's wrong. So I went to a counselor, and she said, after the divorce, she said, "Now, are you happy?" And I go, "Yeah, I'm happy." And she goes, "Are you angry?" I go, "I don't know." She said, "Are you sad?" I go, "I don't know." I didn't really know how I felt because I had covered up those feelings for so long to make things work, the convent work, the marriage work. I didn't really know. I was kind of out of touch with myself. So she put me in a group of women that, like a support group, and we read that book, Women Who Love Too Much, and we shared stories. And I was sitting in the group and listening to these women talk and where they came from and what their situations were. And I thought, these women are just nuts. They're wackos. I mean, how would you let anybody do that to you? And then when I had to tell my story, the words came out, and no longer were the words out of my mouth, and go, "Oh, my gosh, I'm one of them." And so from then, I got a private counselor and worked through a lot of things. And this one counselor was wonderful. He just said, "You're okay. You're not nuts." I mean, he said, "You're just kind of developing lately." And he said, "What's happening now is," he said, "you know, most people go through what you're going through now in college. You know, while people were experimenting with their identity and what they liked and what made them happy and who they want to hang around with and how much they wanted to drink, they all did that in college. And you did not have that opportunity." And he said, "Just like when you get a childhood disease, you breathe through it like the measles. But if you get it as an adult, it's a little bit harder." And so I worked with him and lots of people and did a lot of reading. And, you know, I think I'm better today.
So as you put it in secret number 7, happiness is not a gift but a skill.
Right. You have to find out really what makes you happy, and you're responsible for it. Make yourself happy. People think it's just a gift, and they look around at other people, and they're envious, and they're jealous and of their happiness. And it's like, you have to make yourself happy. Find out who you are and what it takes for you to be happy, and then go get it.
Well, as you say in Secret 5, good judgment comes from experience, and experience comes from bad judgment.
Right, that's a great one, and I got that from a fortune cookie, and so that kind of takes the guilt away from thinking that you just have to be perfect all the time. Right. People said, "Was it a mistake to go on the convent?" No. Was it a mistake to marry? No. I mean, it's just bad, you know, poor judgment that I learned from and made me who I am today. So I don't think anything is a big mistake. We just have to learn from our mistakes and change that paradigm that, you know, everything has to be perfect and we can't make mistakes. We can make a misstep, but we have to learn from it and go on. Otherwise, it is a mistake.
The title of the book, A Change of Habit, A Spiritual Journey from Sister Mary Kateri to Sister Mary Vodka, 7 Secrets to Guilt-Free Living. And the author is Patty Kogatek. Patty, tell us how to get your book.
The best way to do it is you can go to my website. It's called achangeofhabit.net, and you could order it there, or you can go to Balboa Press and order it, or you can go to Amazon.com or Barnes & Noble, and it's available in hardback, softback, and an e-version.
And this interview with Patty is brought to everyone by Balboa Press. Patty, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Steve. It's nice talking with you.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages. Want to be challenged in a powerful way to leap beyond what you think is possible? Then join us Mondays for the Leah Jansen Show. Every Monday at 10 a.m., 9 a.m. Central on TogiNet.com with Leah Jansen. Listen live as life coach Leah uses her coaching skills to give you the tools you need to take action and create momentum. You are encouraged to call in and share your greatest fears, challenges, and obstacles. And then listen as Leah obliterates those barriers to success. For more on Leah and the show, check out her website, LeahJansen.com. That's Leah, LeahJansen.com. Spend 1 hour with Leah, and you'll be captivated by her energy, enthusiasm, and magnetism. You'll quickly become addicted to her positive attitude and make-it-happen mentality. Ready for a life-changing, mood-altering show? Then get ready for Leah Jansen. And listen live to The Leah Jansen Show every Monday morning at 10 a.m., 9 a.m. Central on TogiNet.com.
People think I've made it. I'm popular. I seem happy all the time. I have great clothes and I'm involved in everything. But I have questions, doubts, and fears, just like every other teenager. That's why I'm glad for Teen Talk Radio, where it's all about choices.
Join us for Teen Talk Radio with Nicole Odell, Thursday nights at 10, 9 central on TogiNet.com.
The choices we have to make that can alter the course of our lives. Life is too much pressure if we try to go it alone. I tune in to Teen Talk Radio with Nicole Odell every week to get reminded that I'm not alone. Nicole Odell is an expert on what happens in the lives of teenagers. Join her as she deals with topics like peer pressure, purity, drugs, alcohol, and many other things that might come up along the way. She writes books and speaks to people all over the place, but she says her favorite moments are when she can pull up a chair and chat with teens about what's important to us.
For more information on Nicole and her books, go to NicoleOdell.com. Then join us for Teen Talk Radio with Nicole Odell, Thursday nights at 10, 9 central on TogiNet.com.
Teen Talk Radio, where it's all about choices.
Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
The title of the book, Betrayers, No Left Turn. And the authors are Robert and Heidi Eckert-Budick. And Heidi joins us now on Indie Book Publishing, this interview brought to you by Trafford Publishing. Hello, Heidi.
Hello, Chief.
Well, good to have you with us. You're 86 years young, very patriotic. You and your husband decided to write this book, and were able to do that before he passed away. Let me read just a couple things about No Left Turn. You say this is dedicated to your 6 children. A wise man once said something like this: if one forgets or never learns the truth of history and the mistakes that were made, one is condemned to repeat those mistakes. And this series is intended to tell you the truth about America, the mistakes that have been made, who made them, how many of those mistakes are in the process of being repeated or will be repeated and unfold in your lifetime. So this is a message to the future generations, right?
Correct. That's what we wanted to deal with, the future generations.
So you and your husband, when did you first know that you needed to write this book? Why? What was the motivation?
Both my husband and I had backgrounds that were very troubling times. And we were looking around in America and we saw that things weren't going like they used to. And we were looking at our children and the grandchildren and said, oh, Lord, how are they going to deal with all this? We need to put something in writing so we make clear what our thoughts are on that, our experiences, and what we fear will happen if we do not change the course that the government has taken up.
So you have some very strong feelings about the government has betrayed the people.
Yes, we do.
Tell us some more about how you see that.
I see that the Constitution is very clear on many things, our freedom especially, and the governments have betrayed the Constitution in so many ways, by constantly telling us what to do, when to do it, where to do it, etc. The freedom to think It's just all that's left, actually, because they wouldn't know what we're thinking. But everything else is under the control of the government, I'm sorry to say. But even what we eat, they try to tell us what to eat and what not to eat. And this is very, very disturbing to a person that is looking for freedom of action and the freedom of anything in life.
I see in section one, which is titled Common Man, Who Is He?, you have George Washington's farewell address. Why did you put his farewell address in your book?
Because it tells us and warns us so much about what not to do and to watch out what is threatening our country and be cautious about going into other countries and trying to tell them what to do. He, I guess, had a clear view of the future if people become outrageously preoccupied with their own fame and glory.
In that same section, you also it contains the Constitution of the United States. And you talk about the spider and the fly. Now, why did you put that a metaphor into your book?
Well, it's on the back of the book. And it just was really funny. We read about that somewhere in Robert, and we talked about it, and other people were talking about it. The spider is in a very... As it says in that little paragraph, is in a very difficult position. You know? He's got to have his web to catch food, and we should not get caught in those webs. Yeah, and it's like a tax imposes on the flies. And when you get into the flies, well, when you get into the web, you have no choice but acting to what the web dictates you, which in this case is our tax code and so forth. It just seemed like it was kind of an appropriate analogy of how we get caught in the web that the government is weaving.
You also point out failed education. You have some strong feelings about that.
Yes. Okay, education in America was when my children started going to school. I was a bit disappointed about the level of knowledge that they received through grade school. Then in high school, it got better. But when I think about my education in Germany, what we learned when we were still in fourth, fifth grade, we learned in fifth grade, we started to learn two foreign languages, and we had math and algebra and all of that. For children here, they do not get the expand of knowledge that they need to enter the economic world of today. And I was very afraid that my grandchildren and so forth would fall into that category. Now, my children did a good job of bringing the children to schools that have expansive plans to teach the children what they need to know to get forward in this world.
Now, you have a section titled How Politics Appears to People, how politicians destroyed the American Golden Goose Empire, or Golden Goose. What do you mean by that?
Well, the politicians look out for themselves, first of all. They want to make sure that their own pockets are filled. We are only secondary in their calculations, except that they need to get the votes to keep on going. I'm sorry, I have a very low opinion of politicians in America. Probably they're the same all over the world. But when you look at what the politicians are doing, they're enticing us to vote for them by giving us plans and promises and just outrageous things that they know they cannot keep, like the Social Security and the Medicare from the day go. It was just financially impossible to maintain it, and they had to know it. I mean, they are not stupid. They're greedy, but they're not stupid. So that's why we talked about that.
So you see that as a lie that people can be taken care of?
Yes. It's not possible. Look at our debt right now. How in the world can we keep on doing what we're doing? The money is not there. The people that pay the taxes and where the money is supposed to come from are not there. True, we can tax the rich some more. But if the rich have no money to invest, then what's going to happen to our economy, et cetera, et cetera? You know, it's all a three-ring circus to me. I mean, to have trillions of debt, even the word trillion is something that was not in anybody's vocabulary 20, 30 years ago. Now it's a common thing. And that is so much money. There is no way we can pay that off that I can see, unless they make some serious, serious efforts in containing government spending.
So you charge these politicians with betrayal. They're elected or appointed. They took an oath to defend the Constitution, but you don't see them doing that.
That's correct. That is correct. Do you see them do that?
Well, the news is filled with certainly evidence that they're not.
Okay, so I'm not the only one, am I?
Right.
We are not the only ones, are we?
And you point out that they have a constitutional requirement not only to provide for the common defense, but promote the common good. So that's a real key, isn't it? They're not promoting the common good.
No, to provide is one word. To promote is another word. Provide is you must do it. You should give the attention to the defense of this country. You should keep us in a safe position. To promote means you can encourage people to and maybe help them along the way to achieve the common good, to be have jobs, to learn, to increase your knowledge so you can get a job. They need to promote that, not provide for it. That's totally two different words.
Let's talk about Section 5. It's titled United States Government, and then there's a subsection called Friend or Foe. Tell us about that.
Well, the government can be either your friend or your foe. If you are friendly with the government and do as they want you to do, you know, then the government can do a lot of things for you. But it can become a foe if you try to fight them. And the tax system is probably one of the good examples of you become a foe for the government if you find ways of living your life without being caught in the tax dilemma, which means that you are have a business that is independent and it is no employees, so that you do not get involved in paying all these taxes that you're required to pay and all the instructions that you have to follow as far as employment is concerned. If you have a employee-free business, and you just work on your own, then you're free. You know, so then the government is not a foe. But if you work with the government closely, you can't help but becoming involved in taxes and things like that.
Americans in general, would you say, take their freedom for granted?
Yes, I think so. I think they take it for granted because slowly it has gotten lost. What real freedom is. that you're free of the enforcements of the law. Every day, every step you take, there's a law that governs you. And the real freedom that our forefathers had to conduct their lives in peace and according to their own convictions has kind of gotten lost.
One of the challenges, you say, in writing the book, you didn't want to become an extremist, but in the process, these are very strong, obviously, a very strong statements and a very strong view of what's happening today.
Well, just having opinions about what is going on and strong opinions that this is wrong, what they're doing, does not make, in my opinion, you an extremist. An extremist is a person that goes way out in left or right field and is totally out of context and out of contact with the real life of Americans. I do not think this book is an extremist book at all. It reflects what so many people feel and think and suffer under, but they do not have a way of getting out from under it. They have to go along and get along unless we elect people that become more constitution conscious, that become more conscious of our freedom to live our lives the way we want to decide to live it, to believe what we want to believe. If they do not elect people like that, people that are not, that you cannot bribe, that only look out for themselves, people that really believe when they take the oath just on the Constitution, then really believe it and live it while they are governing us. Until that happens, our freedom is in danger. I wanted also to let the Americans know, my husband Robert and I, we loved America. He was from a small town in Minnesota. He grew up through the Depression and World War II, and he was a soldier for 32 years. And he loved America, he loved his family, and he did everything he could to support both. Now, I am an immigrant. I grew up in Germany under Hitler and lived through World War II in Germany. Then I went to England and then came to America. When I came to America, I got off the boat, I saw the lady in the harbor, and I was so excited. And we came to Chicago, and the first summer of 52 was such a revelation to me of what America is all about. My husband was free to find a job, I was free to find a job. My children, we took them everywhere. It was just, and everything was available. And I knew this was a country where I could build a future for myself and for the children and my husband as well. And it was a wonderful, wonderful decades I lived in this country. And may God defend and bless it. And that's one of the reasons both Robert and I wanted to write these books, to maybe share our concerns with America's future with them, and our concern for the welfare of our children and grandchildren.
We've been talking with Heidi Eggert-Budick, and she and her husband Robert have written the book Betrayers, No Left Turn. Heidi, tell us how to get your book.
Well, you can order it from Trafford Company. You can order it on the computer. It's some bookstores take the orders for the book. I think all of them do.
Right.
So there are different ways of getting it. No.
Well, we appreciate you being with us, Heidi, on this interview for Indie Book Publishing, brought to everyone by Trafford Publishing. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen. Join us again next week at noon Eastern as Steve interviews another great author.